George Eliot or Emily Bronte. In 1888, an English scholar wrote, "Women are not only not part of the race, they are not even half of the race, but a subspecies destined uniquely for reproduction." Mrs. Fawcett founded a suffragist movement toward the end of the century, but as in France, the movement was hesitant. Around 1903, feminist claims took a singular turn. In London, the Pankhurst family created the Women's Social and Political Union, which joined with the Labour Party and embarked on resolutely militant activities. It was the first time in history that women took on a cause as women. This is what gave particular interest to the suffragettes in England and America. For 15 years, they carried out a policy recalling, in some respects, a Gandhi-like attitude. Refusing violence, they invented more or less ingenious symbolic actions. They marched on the Albert Hall during Liberal Party meetings, carrying banners with the words, "Vote for Women." They forced their way into Lord Asquith's office, held meetings in Hyde Park or Trafalgar Square, marched in the streets carrying signs and held lectures. During demonstrations, they insulted the police or threw stones at them, provoking their arrest. In prison, they adopted the hunger strike tactic. They raised money and rallied millions of women and men. They influenced opinion so well that in 1907, 200 members of parliament made up a committee for women's suffrage. Every year from then on, some of them would propose a law in favor of women's suffrage, a law that would be rejected every year with the same arguments. In 1907, the WSPU organized the first march on Parliament with workers covered in shawls and a few aristocratic women. The police pushed them back, but the following year, as married women were threatened with a ban on work in certain mines, the Lancashire women workers were called by the WSPU to hold a grand meeting. There were new arrests, and the imprisoned suffragettes responded with a long hunger strike. Released, they organized new parades. One of the women rode a horse painted with the head of Queen Elizabeth. On July 18, 1910, the day the women's suffrage law went to the chamber, a 9-kilometer-long column paraded through London. The law rejected, there were more meetings and new arrests. In 1912, they adopted a more violent tactic. They burned empty houses, slashed pictures, trampled flower beds, threw stones at the police. At the same time, they sent delegation upon delegation to Lloyd George and Sir Edward Grey. They hid in the Albert Hall and noisily disrupted Lloyd George's speeches. The war interrupted their activities. It is difficult to know how much these actions hastened events. The vote was granted to English women first in 1918 in a restricted form, and then in 1928 without restriction. Their success was in large part due to the services they had rendered during the war. The American woman found herself at first more emancipated than the European. Early in the 19th century, pioneer women had to share the hard work done by men, and they fought by their sides. They were far fewer than men, and thus a high value was placed on them. But little by little, their condition came to resemble that of women in the old world. Gallantry toward them was maintained. They kept their cultural privileges and a dominant position within the family. Laws granted them a religious and moral role, but the command of society resided in the male's hands. Some women began to claim their political rights around 1830. They undertook a campaign in favor of blacks. As the anti-slavery Congress held in 1840 in London was closed to them, the Quaker Lucretia Mott founded a feminist association. On July 18, 1840, at the Seneca Falls Convention, they drafted a Quaker-inspired declaration, which set the tone for all of American feminism. That all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted. He, man, has made her, if married, in the eye of the law, civilly dead. He has usurped the prerogative of Jehovah himself, claiming it as his right to assign for her a sphere of action when that belongs to her conscience and her God. Note, the convention actually took place July 19 to 20, 1848. Translation. 3 years later, Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, arousing the public in favor of blacks. Emerson and Lincoln supported the feminist movement. When the Civil War broke out, women ardently participated. But in vain, they demanded that the amendment giving blacks the right to vote be drafted as follows. The right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race, color, sex. Seizing on the ambiguity of one of the articles to the amendment, the great feminist leader Susan B. Anthony voted in Rochester with 14 comrades. She was fined $100. In 1869, she founded what later came to be called the National American Woman Suffrage Association. And that same year, the state of Wyoming gave women the right to vote. But it was only in 1893 that Colorado, then 1896, Idaho, and Utah, followed this example. Progress was slow afterward, but women succeeded better economically than in Europe. In 1900, 5 million women worked, 1.3 million in industry, 500,000 in business. A large number worked in business, industry, and liberal professions. There were lawyers, doctors, and 3,373 women pastors. The famous Mary Baker Eddy founded the Christian Science Church. Women formed clubs. In 1900, they totaled about 2 million members. Nonetheless, only 9 states had given women the vote. In 1913, the suffrage movement was organized on the militant English model. 2 women led it, Dora Stevens and a young Quaker, Alice Paul. From Wilson, they obtained the right to march with banners and signs. Note, that is, President Woodrow Wilson. Translation. They then organized a campaign of lectures, meetings, marches, and manifestations of all sorts. From the 9 states where women voted, women voters went with great pomp and circumstance to the Capitol, demanding the feminine vote for the whole nation. In Chicago, the first group of women assembled in a party to liberate their sex. This assembly became the Women's Party. In 1917, suffragettes invented a new tactic. They stationed themselves at the doors of the White House, banners in hand, and often chained to the gates so they could not be driven away. After 6 months, they were stopped and sent to the Occoquan Penitentiary. They went on a hunger strike and were finally released. New demonstrations led to the beginning of riots. The government finally consented to naming a House Committee on Woman Suffrage. The Executive Committee of the Women's Party held a conference in Washington, and an amendment favoring the woman's vote went to the House and was voted on January 10, 1918. The vote still had to go to the Senate. Wilson would not promise to exert enough pressure, so the suffragettes began to demonstrate again. They held a rally at the White House doors. The president decided to address an appeal to the Senate, but the amendment was rejected by 2 votes. A Republican Congress voted for the amendment in June 1919. The battle for complete equality of the sexes went on for the next 10 years. At the 6th International Conference of American States, held in Havana in 1928, women obtained the creation of the Inter-American Commission of Women. In 1933, the Montevideo Treaties elevated women's status by international convention. 19 American republics signed the convention, giving women equality in all rights. Sweden also had a very sizable feminist movement. Invoking old traditions, Swedish women demanded the right to education, work, and liberty. It was largely women writers who led the fight. And it was the moral aspect of the problem that interested them at first. Then, grouped in powerful associations, they won over the liberals but ran up against the hostility of the conservatives. Norwegian women in 1907 and Finnish women in 1906 obtained the suffrage that Swedish women would have to wait years to attain. In Latin and Eastern countries, woman was oppressed by customs more than bylaws. In Italy, fascism systematically hindered feminism's progress. seeking the alliance of the church, which continued to uphold family tradition and a tradition of feminine slavery. Fascist Italy held woman in double bondage, to public authority and to her husband. The situation was very different in Germany. In 1790, Hippel, a student, launched the first German feminist manifesto. Sentimental feminism, analogous to that of George Sand, flourished at the beginning of the 19th century. In 1848, the first German woman feminist, Louise Otto, demanded the right for women to assist in the transformation of their country. Her feminism was largely nationalistic. She founded the General German Women's Association in 1865. German socialists, along with Babel, advocated the abolition of the inequality of the sexes. In 1892, Clara Zetkin joined the party's council. Women workers and women socialists grouped together in a federation. German women failed in 1914 to establish a women's national army, but they took an active part in the war. After the German defeat, they obtained the right to vote and participated in political life. Rosa Luxemburg fought next to Liebknecht in the Spartacus group and was assassinated in 1919. The majority of German women chose the Party of Order. Several took seats in the Reichstag. It was thus upon emancipated women that Hitler imposed the new Napoleonic ideal, Kinder, Küche, Kirche. Woman's presence dishonors the Reichstag, he declared. As Nazism was anti-Catholic and anti-bourgeois, he gave the mother a privileged place. Protection granted to unmarried mothers and illegitimate children greatly freed woman from marriage. As in Sparta, she was more dependent on the state than on any individual, giving her both more and less autonomy than a bourgeois woman living under a capitalist regime. In Soviet Russia, the feminist movement made the greatest advances. It began at the end of the 19th century among women students of the intelligentsia. They were less attached to their personal cause than to revolutionary action in general. They went to the people and used nihilistic methods against the Okhrana. In 1878, Vera Zasulik shot the police chief Trepov. During the Russo-Japanese War, women replaced men in many areas of work. Their consciousness raised. The Russian Union for Women's Rights demanded political equality of the sexes. In the first Duma, a parliamentary women's rights group was created, but it was powerless. Women workers' emancipation would come from the revolution. Already in 1905, they were actively participating in the mass political strikes that broke out in the country, and they mounted the barricades. On March 8, 1917, International Women's Day, and a few days before the revolution, they massively demonstrated in the streets of St. Petersburg, demanding bread, peace, and their husbands' return. They took part in the October insurrection. Between 1918 and 1920, they played an important economic and even military role in the USSR's fight against the invaders. True to Marxist tradition, Lenin linked women's liberation to that of the workers. He gave them political and economic equality. Article 122 of the 1936 Constitution stipulates, in the USSR, woman enjoys the same rights as man in all aspects of economic, official, cultural, public, and political life. And these principles were spelled out by the Communist International. It demands social equality of man and woman before the law and in daily life, radical transformation in conjugal rights and in the family code, recognition of maternity as a social function, entrusting society with the care and education of children and adolescents, organization of a civil effort against ideology and traditions that make woman a slave. In the economic area, woman's conquests were stunning. She obtained equal wages with male workers, and she took on a highly active role in production, thereby gaining considerable political and social importance. The brochure recently published by the Association France-USSR reports that in the 1939 general elections, there were 457,000 women deputies in the regional, district, town, and village Soviets, 1,480 in the Socialist Republics of Higher Soviets, and 227 seated in the Supreme Soviet of the USSR. Close to 10 million are members of unions. They constitute 40% of the population of USSR workers and employees, and a great number of workers among the Stakhanovites are women. The role of Russian women in the last war is well known. They provided an enormous labor force, even in production branches, where masculine professions are dominant. Metallurgy and mining, timber rafting and railways, and so forth. They distinguished themselves as pilots and parachutists, and they formed partisan armies. This participation of women in public life has raised a difficult problem, her role in family life. For a long while, means were sought to free her from her domestic constraints. On November 16, 1942, the Plenary Assembly of the Comintern proclaimed, "The revolution is impotent as long as the notion of family and family relations subsists. Respect for free unions, liberalization of divorce, and legalization of abortion ensured woman's liberty relative to men. Laws for maternity leave, child care centers, kindergartens, and so on lightened the burdens of motherhood." From passionate and contradictory witness reports, it is difficult to discern what woman's concrete situation really was. What is sure is that today, the demands of repopulation have given rise to a different family policy. The family has become the elementary social cell, and woman is both worker and housekeeper. Note: Olga Michakova, secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Youth Organization, stated in 1944 in an interview, "Soviet women should try to make themselves as attractive as nature and good taste permit. After the war, they should dress like women and act feminine. Girls will be told to act and walk like girls, and that is why they will wear skirts that will probably be very tight, making them carry themselves gracefully." Sexual morality is at its strictest since the law of June 1936, reinforced by that of June 7, 1941. Abortion has been banned and divorce almost suppressed. Adultery is condemned by moral standards. Strictly subordinated to the state like all workers, strictly bound to the home, but with access to political life and the dignity that productive work gives, the Russian woman is in a singular situation that would be worth studying in its singularity. Circumstances unfortunately prevent me from doing this. The recent session of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women demanded that equal rights for both sexes be recognized in all nations, and several motions were passed to make this legal status a concrete reality. It would seem, then, that the match is won. The future can only bring greater and greater assimilation of women in a hitherto masculine society. Several conclusions come to the fore when taking a look at this history as a whole. And first of all, this one. Women's entire history has been written by men. Just as in America, there is no black problem, but a white one. Note, refer to Myrdal, An American Dilemma. Just as anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem, it's our problem. Note, Jean-Paul Sartre, Réflexion sur la question juive, Anti-Semite and Jew. So the problem of woman has always been a problem of men. Why they had moral prestige at the outset along with physical strength has been discussed. They created the values, customs, and religions. Never did women attempt to vie for that empire. A few isolated women, Sappho, Christine de Pizan, Mary Wollstonecraft, Olympe de Gouges, protested against their harsh destiny, and there were some collective demonstrations. But Roman matrons in league against the Oppian Law or Anglo-Saxon suffragettes only managed to wield pressure because men were willing to submit to it. Men always held woman's lot in their hands, and they did not decide on it based on her interest. It is their own projects, fears, and needs that counted. When they revered the mother goddess, it is because nature frightened them, and as soon as the bronze tool enabled them to assert themselves against nature, they instituted patriarchy. Henceforth, it was the family-state conflict that has defined woman status. It is the attitude of the Christian before God, the world, and his own flesh that is reflected in the condition he assigned to her. What was called the querelle des femmes in the Middle Ages was a quarrel between clergy and laity about marriage and celibacy. It is the social regime founded on private property that brought about the married woman's wardship, and it is the technical revolution realized by men that enfranchised today's women. It is an evolution of the masculine ethic that led to the decrease in family size by birth control and partially freed woman from the servitude of motherhood. Feminism itself has never been an autonomous movement. It was partially an instrument in the hands of politicians and partially an epiphenomenon reflecting a deeper social drama. Never did women form a separate caste, and in reality, they never sought to play a role in history as a sex. The doctrines that call for the advent of woman as flesh, life, immanence, or the other are masculine ideologies that do not in any way express feminine claims. For the most part, women resign themselves to their lot without attempting any action. Those who did try to change attempted to overcome their singularity and not to confine themselves in it triumphantly. When they intervened in world affairs, it was in concert with men and from a masculine point of view. This intervention, in general, was secondary and occasional. The women who enjoyed a certain economic autonomy and took part in production were the oppressed classes, and as workers, they were even more enslaved than male workers. In the ruling classes, woman was a parasite and, as such, was subjugated to masculine laws. In both cases, it was almost impossible for her to act. Law and custom did not always coincide, and a balance was set up between them so that woman was never concretely free. In the ancient Roman Republic, economic conditions give the matron concrete powers, but she has no legal independence. The same is often true in peasant civilizations, and among lower middle-class tradesmen, mistress-servant inside the home, woman is socially a minor. Inversely, in periods when society fragments, woman becomes freer, but she loses her fief when she ceases to be man's vassal. She has nothing but a negative freedom that is expressed only in license and dissipation. As, for example, during the Roman decadence, the Renaissance, the 18th century, and the Directoire, either she finds work but is enslaved, or she is enfranchised but can do nothing else with herself. It is worth noting, among other points, that the married woman had her place in society, but without benefiting from any rights, while the single woman, honest girl or prostitute, had all man's capacities. But until this century, she was more or less excluded from social life. The opposition between law and custom produced this, among other curious paradoxes. Free love is not prohibited by law, but adultery is a crime. The girl that falls, however, is often dishonored, while the wife's shocking behavior is treated indulgently. From the 18th century to today, many young girls got married so that they could freely have lovers. This ingenious system kept the great mass of women under guardianship. It takes exceptional circumstances for a feminine personality to be able to affirm itself between these two series of constraints, abstract or concrete. Women who have accomplished works comparable to men's are those whom the force of social institutions had exalted beyond any sexual differentiation. Isabella the Catholic, Elizabeth of England, and Catherine of Russia were neither male nor female. They were sovereigns. It is remarkable that once socially abolished, their femininity no longer constituted inferiority. There were infinitely more queens with great reigns than kings. Religion undergoes the same transformation. Catherine of Siena and Saint Teresa are saintly souls, beyond any physiological condition. Their lay life and their mystical life, their actions and their writings, rise to heights that few men ever attain. It is legitimate to think that if other women failed to mark the world deeply, it is because they were trapped by their conditions. they were only able to intervene in a negative or indirect way. Judith, Charlotte Corday, and Vera Zasulik assassinate. The Frondeuses conspire. During the Revolution and the Commune, women fight alongside men against the established order, intransigent refusal and revolt against a freedom without rights and power are permitted. Whereas it is forbidden for a woman to participate in positive construction, at best she will manage to insinuate herself into masculine enterprises by indirect means. Aspasia, Madame de Maintenon, and the Princesse des Ursins were precious advisors, but someone still had to consent to listen to them. Men tend to exaggerate the scope of this influence when trying to convince women she has the greater role. But in fact, feminine voices are silenced when concrete action begins. They might foment wars, not suggest battle tactics. They oriented politics only in as much as politics was limited to intrigue. The real reins of the world have never been in women's hands. They had no role either in technology or in economy. They neither made nor unmade states. They did not discover worlds. They did set off some events, but they were pretexts more than agents. Lucretia's suicide had no more than a symbolic value. Martyrdom remains allowed for the oppressed. During Christian persecutions and in the aftermath of social or national defeats, women played this role of witness. But a martyr has never changed the face of the world. Even feminine demonstrations and initiatives were only worth something if a masculine decision positively prolonged them. The American women, united around Harriet Beecher Stowe, aroused public opinion to fever pitch against slavery. But the real reasons for the Civil War were not sentimental. The March 8, 1917, Woman's Day, might have triggered the Russian Revolution, but it was nonetheless merely a signal. Most feminine heroines are extravagant, adventurers or eccentrics, notable less for their actions than for their unique destinies. Take Joan of Arc, Madame Roland, and Flora Tristan. If they are compared with Richelieu, Danton, or Lenin, it is clear their greatness is mainly subjective. They are exemplary figures more than historical agents. A great man springs from the mass and is carried by circumstances. The mass of women is at the fringes of history, and for each of them, circumstances are an obstacle and not a springboard. To change the face of the world, one has first to be firmly anchored to it. But women, firmly rooted in society, are those subjugated by it, unless they are designated for action by divine right. And in this case, they are shown to be as capable as men. The ambitious woman and the heroine are strange monsters. Only since women have begun to feel at home on this earth has a Rosa Luxemburg or a Madame Curie emerged. They brilliantly demonstrate that it is not women's inferiority that has determined their historical insignificance. It is their historical insignificance that has doomed them to inferiority. Note, it is worth noting that out of 1,000 statues in Paris, not counting the queens that compose the corbel of the Luxembourg and fulfill a purely architectural role, there are only 10 raised to women. Three are devoted to Joan of Arc. The others are Madame de Ségur, George Sand, Sarah Bernhardt, Madame Boucicault and the Baronne de Hirsch, Maria d'Eresme and Rosa Bonheur. This fact is striking in the cultural field, the area in which they have been the most successful in asserting themselves. Their lot has been closely linked to literature and the arts. Among the ancient Germans, the roles of prophetess and priestess fell to women. Because they are marginal to the world, men will look to them when they strive, through culture, to bridge the limits of their universe and reach what is other. Courtly mysticism, humanist curiosity, and the taste for beauty that thrive in the Italian Renaissance, the preciousness of the 17th century, and the progressive ideal of the 18th century bring about an exaltation of femininity in diverse forms. Woman is thus the main pole of poetry and the substance of works of art. Her leisure allows her to devote herself to the pleasures of the mind, inspiration, critic, writer's audience, she emulates the writer. She can often impose a type of sensitivity, an ethic that feeds men's hearts, which is how she intervenes in her own destiny. Women's education is mainly a feminine conquest. And yet, as important as this collective role played by intellectual women is, their individual contributions are, on the whole, of a lesser order. Woman holds a privileged place in the fields of the mind and art because she is not involved in action, but art and thinking derive their impetus in action. Being on the fringes of the world is not the best place for someone who intends to recreate it. Here again, to go beyond the given, one must be deeply rooted in it. Personal accomplishments are almost impossible in human categories collectively kept in an inferior situation. "Where can one go in skirts?" asked Marie Bashkirtseff. And Stendhal, "All the geniuses who are born women are lost for the public good." If truth be told, one is not born but becomes a genius, and the feminine condition has, until now, rendered this becoming impossible. Anti-feminists draw two contradictory arguments from examining history. 1. Women have never created anything grand. 2. Woman's situation has never prevented great women personalities from blossoming. There is bad faith in both of these assertions. The successes of some few privileged women neither compensate for nor excuse the systematic degrading of the collective level. And the very fact that these successes are so rare and limited is proof of their unfavorable circumstances. As Christine de Pizan, Poulain de la Barre, Condorcet, John Stuart Mill, and Stendhal stated, women have never been given their chances in any area. This explains why many of them today demand a new status, and once again, their demand is not to be exalted in their femininity. They want transcendence to prevail over immanence in themselves as in all of humanity. They want abstract rights and concrete possibilities to be granted to them, without which freedom is merely mystification. Note, here too the anti-feminists are equivocal. At times, holding abstract liberty to be nothing, they glorify the great concrete role the enslaved woman can play in this world. What more does she want? And other times, they underestimate the fact that negative license does not open any concrete possibilities, and they blame abstractly enfranchised women for not having proven themselves. This will is being fulfilled, but this is a period of transition. This world that has always belonged to men is still in their hands. Patriarchal civilizations, institutions, and values are still, to a great extent, alive. Abstract rights are far from being wholly granted to women. In Switzerland, women still cannot vote. In France, the 1942 law upholds the husband's prerogatives in a weaker form. And abstract rights, as has just been said, have never been sufficient to guarantee woman a concrete hold on the world. There is not yet real equality today between the two sexes. First, the burdens of marriage are still much heavier for woman than for man. We have seen that the constraints of pregnancy have been limited by the overt or clandestine use of birth control, but the practice is neither universally disseminated nor rigorously applied. As abortion is officially forbidden, many women either jeopardize their health by resorting to unregulated abortion methods or are overwhelmed by the number of their pregnancies. Childcare, like housekeeping, is still almost exclusively the woman's burden. In France, in particular, the anti-feminist tradition is so tenacious that a man would think it demeaning to participate in chores previously reserved for women. The result is that woman has a harder time reconciling her family and work life. In cases where society demands this effort from her, her existence is much more difficult than her spouse's. Take, for example, the lot of peasant women. In France, they make up the majority of the women involved in productive labor, and they are generally married. The single woman most often remains a servant in the father's, brother's, or sister's household. She only becomes mistress of a home by accepting a husband's domination. depending on the region, customs and traditions impose various roles on her. The Norman peasant woman presides over the meal, while the Corsican woman does not sit at the same table as the men. But in any case, as she plays one of the most important roles in the domestic economy, she shares the man's responsibilities, his interests, and his property. She is respected, and it is often she who really governs. Her situation is reminiscent of the place she held in ancient agricultural communities. She often has as much moral prestige as her husband, and sometimes even more, but her concrete condition is much harsher. The care of the garden, barnyard, sheepfold, and pigpen falls on her alone. She takes part in the heavy work, cleaning the cowshed, spreading the manure, sowing, plowing, hoeing, and haymaking. She digs, weeds, harvests, picks grapes, and sometimes helps load and unload wagons of straw, hay, wood and sticks, litter, and so on. In addition, she prepares the meals and manages the household, washing, mending, and such. She assumes the heavy burdens of pregnancies and childcare. She rises at dawn, feeds the barnyard and small animals, serves the first meal to the men, takes care of the children, and goes out to the fields or the woods or the kitchen garden. She draws water from the well, serves the second meal, washes the dishes, works in the fields again until dinner, and after the last meal occupies her evening by mending, cleaning, husking the corn, and so forth. As she has no time to take care of her health, even during her pregnancies, she loses her shape quickly and is prematurely withered and worn out, sapped by illnesses. She is denied the few occasional compensations man finds in his social life. He goes to the city on Sundays and fair days, meets other men, goes to the cafe, drinks, plays cards, hunts and fishes. She stays on the farm and has no leisure. Only the rich peasant women, helped by servants or dispensed from field work, lead a pleasantly balanced life. They are socially honored and enjoy greater authority in the home without being crushed by labor. But most of the time, rural work reduces woman to the condition of a beast of burden. The woman shopkeeper, the small business owner, have always been privileged. They are the only ones, since the Middle Ages, whose civil capacities have been recognized by the code. Women grocers, hoteliers, or tobacconists and dairywomen have positions equal to man's. Single or widowed, they have a legal identity of their own. Married, they possess the same autonomy as their husbands. They are fortunate in working and living in the same place, and the work is not generally too consuming. The situation of the woman worker, employee, secretary, or saleswoman working outside the home is totally different. It is much more difficult to reconcile her job with managing the household. Errands, preparation of meals, cleaning, and upkeep of her wardrobe take at least 3.5 hours of work a day and 6 on Sunday. This adds a lot of time to factory or office hours. As for the learned professions, even if women lawyers, doctors, and teachers manage to have some help in their households, the home and children still entail responsibilities and cares that are a serious handicap for them. In America, ingenious technology has simplified housework, but the appearance and elegance demanded of the working woman impose another constraint on her, and she maintains responsibility for the house and children. In addition, the woman who seeks her independence through work has far fewer possibilities than her masculine competitors. Her salary is inferior to man's in many fields. Her job is less specialized and hence doesn't pay as well as that of a skilled worker. And for the same job, the woman is paid less. Because she is new to the world of males, she has fewer chances of success than they. Men and women alike are loath to work under a woman's orders. They always give more confidence to a man. If being a woman is not a defect, it is at least a peculiarity. If she wants to get ahead, it is useful for a woman to make sure she has a man's support. Men are the ones who take the best places, who hold the most important jobs. It must be emphasized that in economic terms, men and women constitute two castes. Note: In America, great business fortunes often end up in women's hands. Younger than their husbands, women outlive and inherit from them. But they are then older and rarely take the initiative of new investments. They act as usufructuaries rather than owners. It is men who dispose of the capital. In any case, these rich, privileged women make up a small minority. In America, more than in Europe, it is almost impossible for a woman to reach a top position as a lawyer or doctor. What determines women's present situation is the stubborn survival of the most ancient traditions in the new emerging civilization. Hasty observers are wrong to think woman is not up to the possibilities offered her today, or even to see only dangerous temptations in these possibilities. The truth is that her situation is tenuous, which makes it very difficult for her to adapt. Factories, offices, and universities are open to women, but marriage is still considered a more honorable career, exempting her from any other participation in collective life. As in primitive civilizations, the amorous act is a service she has the right to be paid for more or less directly. Everywhere but in the USSR, the modern woman is allowed to use her body as capital. Note, at least according to official doctrine. Prostitution is tolerated, seduction encouraged. Note, in Anglo-Saxon countries, prostitution has never been controlled. Until 1900, American and English common law did not deem it a crime unless it was scandalous and disturbed the peace. Since then, there has been more or less repression, applied with varying degrees of harshness and of success in England and America, whose legislation on this point varies a great deal from one state to the other. In France, after a long abolitionist campaign, the April 13, 1946 law ordered brothels to be closed and the fight against procurement to be reinforced. Considering that the existence of these brothels is incompatible with the essential principles of human dignity and the role granted to woman in modern society, prostitution nevertheless continues to be practiced. Negative and hypocritical measures are obviously not the way the situation can be modified. And the married woman can legally make her husband support her. In addition, she is cloaked in much greater social dignity than the unmarried woman. Social customs are far from granting her sexual possibilities on a par with those of the single male. In particular, the unwed mother is an object of scandal, as motherhood is more or less forbidden to her. How could the Cinderella myth not retain its validity? Everything still encourages the girl to expect fortune and happiness from a Prince Charming instead of attempting the difficult and uncertain conquest alone. For example, she can hope to attain a higher caste through him, a miracle her whole life's work will not bring her. But such a hope is harmful because it divides her strength and interests. Note. Refer to Philip Wiley, Generation of Vipers. This split is perhaps the most serious handicap for women. Parents still raise their daughters for marriage rather than promoting their personal development, and the daughter sees so many advantages that she desires it herself. The result is that she is often less specialized, less solidly trained than her brothers. She is less totally committed to her profession. As such, she is doomed to remain inferior in it, and the vicious circle is knotted. This inferiority reinforces her desire to find a husband. Every benefit always has a burden, but if the burden is too heavy, the benefit is no more than a servitude. For most workers today, work is a thankless task. For woman, the chore is not offset by a concrete conquest of her social dignity, freedom of behavior, and economic autonomy. It is understandable that many women workers and employees see no more than an obligation in the right to work from which marriage would deliver them. However, because she has become conscious of self and can emancipate herself from marriage through work, a woman no longer accepts her subjection docilely. What she would hope for, is to reconcile family life and profession, something that does not require exhausting acrobatics. Even then, as long as the temptations of facility remain, from the economic inequality that favors certain individuals and the woman's right to sell herself to one of these privileged people, she needs to expend a greater moral effort than the male to choose the path of independence. It has not been well enough understood that temptation is also an obstacle, and even one of the most dangerous. It is amplified here by a mystification, since there will be one winner out of the thousands in the lucky marriage lottery. Today's period invites, even obliges, women to work, but it lures them with an idyllic and delightful paradise. It raises up the happy few far above those still riveted to this earthly world. Men's economic privilege, their social value, the prestige of marriage, the usefulness of masculine support, all these encourage women to ardently want to please men. They are, on the whole, still in a state of serfdom. It follows that woman knows and chooses herself not as she exists for herself, but as man defines her. She thus has to be described first as men dream of her, since her being for men is one of the essential factors of her concrete condition. Part 3. Myths. Chapter 1. History has shown that men have always held all the concrete powers. From patriarchy's earliest times, they have deemed it useful to keep woman in a state of dependence. Their codes were set up against her. She was thus concretely established as the other. This condition served males' economic interests, but it also suited their ontological and moral ambitions. Once the subject attempts to assert himself, the other, who limits and denies him, is nonetheless necessary for him. He attains himself only through the reality that he is not. That is why man's life is never plenitude and rest. It is lack and movement. It is combat. Facing himself, man encounters nature. He has a hold on it. He tries to appropriate it for himself. But it cannot satisfy him. Either it realizes itself as a purely abstract opposition, it is an obstacle and remains foreign, or it passively submits to man's desire and allows itself to be assimilated by him. He possesses it only in consuming it, that is, in destroying it. In both cases, he remains alone. He is alone when touching a stone, alone when digesting a piece of fruit. The other is present only if the other is himself present to himself. That is, true alterity is a consciousness separated from my own and identical to it. It is the existence of other men that wrests each man from his immanence and enables him to accomplish the truth of his being, to accomplish himself as transcendence, as flight toward the object, as a project. But this foreign freedom, which confirms my freedom, also enters into conflict with it. This is the tragedy of the unhappy consciousness. Each consciousness seeks to posit itself alone as sovereign subject. Each one tries to accomplish itself by reducing the other to slavery. But in work and fear, the slave experiences himself as essential, and by a dialectical reversal, the master appears the inessential one. The conflict can be overcome by the free recognition of each individual in the other, each one positing both itself and the other as object and as subject in a reciprocal movement. But friendship and generosity, which accomplish this recognition of freedoms concretely, are not easy virtues. They are undoubtedly man's highest accomplishment. This is where he is in his truth. But this truth is a struggle endlessly begun, endlessly abolished. It demands that man surpass himself at each instant. Put into other words, man attains an authentically moral attitude when he renounces being in order to assume his existence. Through this conversion, he also renounces all possession, because possession is a way of searching for being. But the conversion by which he attains true wisdom is never finished. It has to be made ceaselessly. It demands constant effort. So much so that, unable to accomplish himself in solitude, man is ceaselessly in jeopardy in his relations with his peers. His life is a difficult enterprise whose success is never assured. But he does not like difficulty. He is afraid of danger. He has contradictory aspirations to both life and rest, existence and being. He knows very well that a restless spirit is the ransom for his development, that his distance from the object is the ransom for his being present to himself. But he dreams of restfulness in restlessness, and of an opaque plenitude that his consciousness would nevertheless still inhabit. This embodied dream is precisely woman. She is the perfect intermediary between nature that is foreign to man and the peer who is too identical to him. She pits neither the hostile silence of nature nor the hard demand of a reciprocal recognition against him. By unique privilege, she is a consciousness, and yet it seems possible to possess her in the flesh. Thanks to her, there is a way to escape the inexorable dialectic of the master and the slave that springs from the reciprocity of freedoms. Note, woman is not the useless repetition of man, but the enchanted space where the living alliance of man and nature occurs. If she disappeared, men would be alone, foreigners without passports in a glacial world. She is earth itself carried to life's summit. The earth becomes sensitive and joyful, and without her, for man, earth is mute and dead, wrote Michel Carouge in Les Pouvoirs de la Femme, Woman's Powers, Cahiers du Sud, number 292, 1948. It has been pointed out that there were not at first free women whom the males then enslaved, and that the sexual division has never founded a division into castes. Assimilating the woman to the slave is a mistake. Among slaves, there were women, but free women have always existed. That is, women invested with religious and social dignity. They accepted man's sovereignty, and he did not feel threatened by a revolt that could transform him, in turn, into an object. Woman thus emerged as the inessential, who never returned to the essential, as the absolute other without reciprocity. All the creation myths express this conviction that is precious to the male. For example, the Genesis legend, which, through Christianity, has spanned Western civilization. Eve was not formed at the same time as man. She was not made either from a different substance or from the same clay that Adam was modeled from. She was drawn from the first male's flank. Even her birth was not autonomous. God did not spontaneously choose to create her for herself and to be directly worshipped in turn. He destined her for man. He gave her to Adam to save him from loneliness. Her spouse is her origin and her finality. She is his complement in the inessential mode. Thus, she appears a privileged prey. She is nature raised to the transparency of consciousness. She is a naturally submissive consciousness, and therein lies the marvelous hope that man has often placed in woman. He hopes to accomplish himself as being through carnally possessing a being while making confirmed in his freedom by a docile freedom. No man would consent to being a woman, but all want there to be women. Thank God for creating woman. Nature is good because it gave men woman. In these and other similar phrases, man once more asserts arrogantly and naively that his presence in this world is an inevitable fact and a right. That of woman is a simple accident, but a fortunate one. Appearing as the other, woman appears at the same time as a plenitude of being by opposition to the nothingness of existence that man experiences in itself. The other, posited as object in the subject's eyes, is posited as in itself, thus as being. Woman embodies positively the lack the existent carries in his heart, and man hopes to realize himself by finding himself through her. But she has not represented for him the only incarnation of the other, and she has not always had the same importance throughout history. In various periods, she has been eclipsed by other idols. When the city or the state devours the citizen, he is no longer in any position to deal with his personal destiny. Dedicated to the state, the Spartan woman has a higher station than that of other Greek women. But she is not transfigured by any masculine dream. The cult of the chief, be it Napoleon, Mussolini, or Hitler, excludes any other. In military dictatorships and totalitarian regimes, woman is no longer a privileged object. It is understandable that woman is divinized in a country that is rich and where the citizens are uncertain about what meaning to give to their lives. This is what is happening in America. In contrast, socialist ideologies, which call for the assimilation of all human beings, reject the notion that any human category, be object or idol, now and for the future. In the authentically democratic society that Marx heralded, there is no place for the other. Few men, however, correspond exactly to the soldier or the militant that they have chosen to be. As long as these men remain individuals, woman retains a singular value in their eyes. I have seen letters written by German soldiers to French prostitutes in which, in spite of Nazism, the tradition of sentimentality proved to be naively alive. Communist writers like Aragon in France and Vittorini in Italy give a front row place in their works to woman as lover and mother. Perhaps the myth of woman will be phased out one day. The more women assert themselves as human beings, the more the marvelous quality of other dies in them. But today, it still exists in the hearts of all men. Any myth implies a subject who projects its hopes and fears of a transcendent heaven. Not positing themselves as subject, women have not created the virile myth that would reflect their projects. They have neither religion nor poetry that belongs to them alone. They still dream through men's dreams. They worship the gods made by males, and males have shaped the great virile figures for their own exaltation. Hercules, Prometheus, Parsifal. In the destiny of these heroes, woman has merely a secondary role. Undoubtedly, there are stylized images of man as he is in his relations with woman, father, seducer, husband, the jealous one, the good son, the bad son. But men are the ones who have established them, and they have not attained the dignity of myth. They are barely more than cliches, while woman is exclusively defined in her relation to man. The asymmetry of the two categories, male and female, can be seen in the unilateral constitution of sexual myths. Woman is sometimes designated as sex. It is she who is the flesh, its delights, and its dangers. That for woman it is man who is sexed and carnal is a truth that has never been proclaimed because there is no one to proclaim it. The representation of the world as the world itself is the work of men. They describe it from a point of view that is their own, and that they confound with the absolute truth. It is always difficult to describe a myth. It does not lend itself to being grasped or defined. It haunts consciousness without ever being posited opposite them as a fixed object. The object fluctuates so much and is so contradictory that its unity is not at first discerned. Delilah and Judith, Aspasia and Lucretia, Pandora and Athena. Woman is both Eve and the Virgin Mary. She is an idol, a servant, source of life, power of darkness. She is the elementary silence of truth. She is artifice, gossip, and lies. She is the medicine woman and witch. She is man's prey. She is his downfall. She is everything he is not and wants to have, his negation and his raison d'être. To be a woman, says Kierkegaard, is something so strange, so confused, and so complicated that no one predicate can express it. And the multiple predicates that might be used contradict each other in such a way that only a woman could put up with it. Note, stages on life's way. This comes from being considered not positively, as she is for herself, but negatively, such as she appears to man. Because if there are other others than the woman, she is still always defined as other, and her ambiguity is that of the very idea of other. It is that of the human condition as defined in its relation with the other. It has already been said that the other is evil, but as it is necessary for the good, it reverts to the good. Through the other, I accede to the whole. But it separates me from the whole. It is the door to infinity and the measure of my finitude. And this is why woman embodies no set concept. Through her, the passage from hope to failure, hatred to love, good to bad, bad to good, takes place ceaselessly. However she is considered, it is this ambivalence that is the most striking. Man seeks the other in woman as nature and as his peer, but nature inspires ambivalent feelings in man, as has been seen. He exploits it, but it crushes him. He is born from and he dies in it. It is the source of his being and the kingdom he bends to his will. It is a material envelope in which the soul is held prisoner, and it is the supreme reality. It is contingency and idea, finitude and totality. It is that which opposes spirit and himself. Both ally and enemy, it appears as the dark chaos from which life springs forth, as this very life, and as the beyond it reaches for. Woman embodies nature as mother, spouse, and idea. These figures are sometimes confounded and sometimes in opposition, and each has a double face. Man sinks his roots in nature. He was engendered like animals and plants. He is well aware that he exists only in as much as he lives. But since the coming of patriarchy, life in man's eyes has taken on a dual aspect. It is consciousness, will, transcendence. It is intellect. And it is matter, passivity, immanence. It is flesh. Aeschylus, Aristotle, and Hippocrates proclaimed that on earth, as on Mount Olympus, it is the male principle that is the true creator. Form, number, and movement come from him. Demeter makes corn multiply, but the origin of corn and its truth are in Zeus. Woman's fertility is considered merely a passive virtue. She is earth and man seed. She is water and he is fire. Creation has often been imagined as a marriage of fire and water. Hot humidity gives birth to living beings. The sun is the spouse of the sea. Sun and fire are male divinities. And the sea is one of the most universally widespread maternal symbols. Inert, water submits to the flamboyant rays that fertilize it. Likewise, the still earth, furrowed by the laborer's toil, receives the seeds in its rows. But its role is necessary. It is the soil that nourishes the seed, shelters it, and provides its substance. Man thus continued to worship fertility goddesses, even once the great mother was dethroned. Note, of Gia sing I, mother firm of all, the eldest one, who feedeth life on earth, whichever walk on land or swim the seas or fly, says a Homeric hymn. Aeschylus also glorifies the earth that gives birth to all beings, nourishes them, and then receives the fertilized germ once again. He owes his harvests, herds, and prosperity to Cybele. He owes her his very life. He exalts water and fire equally. Glory to the sea, glory to its waves encircled by sacred fire. Glory to the wave, glory to the fire, glory to the strange adventure, wrote Goethe in Faust Part 2. He venerated earth, the matron clay, as Blake called it. An Indian prophet advised his disciples not to dig up the earth because it is a sin to hurt or cut, to tear our common mother in agricultural works. Do I take a knife to drive into my mother's breast? Do I mutilate her flesh so as to reach her bones? How could I dare to cut my mother's hair? In central India, the Baidya also thought that it was a sin to rip the breast of their earth mother with the plow. Inversely, Aeschylus says of Oedipus that he dared to sow the sacred furrow where he was formed. Sophocles spoke of paternal furrows and of the laborer, master of a remote field that he visited only once during the sowing. The beloved in an Egyptian song declares, "I am the earth." In Islamic text, woman is called field, grapevine. In one of his hymns, St. Francis of Assisi speaks of our sister, the earth, our mother, who preserves and cares for us, who produces the most varied fruits with many colored flowers and with grass. Michelet, taking mud baths in Acqui, exclaims, "Dear common mother, we are one. I come from you. I return to you." And there are even periods of vitalistic romanticism that affirm the triumph of life over spirit. So the earth's and woman's magic fertility appear to be even more marvelous than the male's concerted works. So the man dreams of once again losing himself in maternal darkness to find the true sources of his being. The mother is the root driven into the depths of the cosmos that taps its vital juices. She is the fountain from which springs forth sweet water that is also mother's milk, a warm spring, a mud formed of earth and water, rich in regenerating forces. Note, to the letter, the woman is Isis, fertile nature. She is the river and the bed of the river, the root and the rose, the earth and the cherry tree, the vine and the grape. M. Carouge, Woman's Powers. But man's revolt against his carnal condition is more general. He considers himself a fallen god. His curse is to have fallen from a luminous and orderly heaven into the chaotic obscurity of the mother's womb. He desires to see himself in this fire, this active and pure breath, and it is woman who imprisons him.